So everyone, welcome to the first class of 2010 on the history of Buddhism. Now, can I just ask before we start, how many people here were here for the last year's series of classes? Okay, that's one. You were here for some of them.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and you remember that? What we talked about last year?
Yeah, the civilization.
And stuff.
Yeah.
And the Big Bang.
The Big Bang, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So those are all on the server somewhere, I presume. So if anyone wants to revise or go over them for the first time, then that would be recommended. I'll try to continue this. And hopefully we'll be able to finish off the history of the world according to Sujato in the next 3 months. So this is more or less continuing off. If everyone remembers, that the last time we got up to the period of discussing the Abhidhamma. So we'd been through the pre-Buddhist development in India, the Upanishads and so on, and then the suttas, post-Buddhist period, the councils, the formation of the schools, King Ashoka. The formation of the Abhidhamma, and that leaves us more or less at the end of what I call the early period of Buddhism. Okay, so just as a matter of terminology, I use the period early Buddhism to refer from the time of the Buddha up to about the beginning of the Common Era, so roughly a 500-year period, and that doctrinally corresponds more or less with the closure of the canonical Abhidhamma texts. It's not the closure of the Abhidhamma movement by any means, because much of what is called Abhidhamma is actually the post-canonical texts. So that period, the early period, more or less encompasses the canonical texts. And then the following period, starting around the beginning of the Common Era, sees the development of, I guess, what you'd call the mature schools of early Buddhism, and also the Mahayana. And that itself has a long and complex history. So over the next several weeks, we're going to be looking at various aspects of this, and what I would like to do is to focus mainly on presenting certain important texts, passages, ideas, but trying to stay as close to the actual like original sources as possible, and then looking at some kind of fragments and examples of those. So we can't be too detailed or systematic in how we approach it, so the purpose of what we're doing now is not to sort of learn in a deep way the later developments in the schools of Buddhism, but more or less to do a survey and get a sample and a taste of what was around. And then hopefully if anybody's interested to pursue those studies any further, then they can do that themselves, or maybe we can do that as a group at a later time if we're interested. Now, one thing I have to say as an important caveat here before we start is that from now on we're leaving my area of expertise, all right? So I've focused mainly on the study of early Buddhism, both the original Buddhism of the Buddha himself taught, and also the way that developed historically through the emergence of the schools and so on, and my studies of the middle period, which we're starting now, and the late period are fairly perfunctory. I haven't done any original research in those areas, and my knowledge of the sources is partial and largely second hand. Okay, so hopefully, I know that some of you may have more knowledge in some of these areas than I do, especially those who practice in Mahayana traditions. So maybe we can draw on some of your experience when it comes time to looking at some of the Mahayana texts. So what I'd like to start today, I don't have any major or great plans for this afternoon's session, but I just thought to start with a bit of an introduction and an orientation, and introduce you to some of the important texts in the area and so on. So just for a start, as an overall summary, we'll have a look at the Kiddipedia. Okay? History of Buddhism, right? This just, here it is. In the 1500s BC, during the later part of the Aryan period in India, the idea of reincarnation became very strong among Hindus. Most people believe that after you died, you'd be reborn again in another form and then reborn again and again forever. But then people started to not like this idea. They didn't want reincarnation to just go on and on forever. Wasn't there any way to stop this? To just get off the wheel of reincarnation and just be? A young Indian prince named Siddhartha Gautama Buddha had an idea. He thought that you could get off the wheel of reincarnation if you were good and pure enough. He refused to be a prince anymore and tried to spend his life being good and pure so he could get off the wheel. Gautama Buddha had many followers during his lifetime, and after he died he had even more. Most of Buddha's followers tried to be good while still living their normal lives, working in the fields or as soldiers, getting married, taking care of their parents and their children. But some of his followers adopted a Jain idea of getting away from the world so they could work full-time on being good and pure. These people were called monks or nuns. In the 300s BC, one of the great Mauryan kings, Ashoka, became a Buddhist, which helped Buddhism to succeed. Ashoka convinced many other Indian people to become Buddhists. At first, most Buddhists were in India, but by 500 AD, Buddhism spread to China and other parts of East Asia. By the 600s AD, most of the Buddhists in India had gone back to being Hindus again. They still remembered Buddha, but as one of many Hindu gods. In China, on the other hand, Buddhism got stronger and stronger. Soon, most of the Buddhists were in China and not India. In China, as in India, most Buddhist people continued to live more or less ordinary lives, but some Buddhist men and women left their jobs and their families in order to live in Buddhist monasteries as monks or nuns. So there you go. That's it in a nutshell, right? So if you think the whole Buddhist history is too complicated, that's for you, all right?
All right.
I thought it was quite cute. And then Siddhartha had an idea. Ooh. Anyway, so that's the potted history of Buddhism. Alrighty. So I'm just going to... just before we start, I'll have a look at this. I might just introduce you to a bit of the literature that I've got here. Most of these things, of course, lurk in my room for my enjoyment. But these are some very useful books for anyone wanting to understand these things. Frau Wellner. Studies in Abhidharma Literature and the Origins of Buddhist Philosophical Systems. Mm-hmm. Fascinating reading. Anybody who wants to, anyone who has insomnia, guaranteed cure. Now, seriously, this is a really excellent study of how the early Abhidhamma evolved and so on. If you're interested, and it's good to have a look at what the Abhidhamma philosophy is about, then you want to have a look at that from like what they call an emic perspective, from the perspective of inside the tradition itself. But Frau Wellner gives probably the most useful etic perspective, like a critical and historical perspective on how the things evolved. So it has a summary of the main Abhidhamma texts from the different schools of Sarvastivada as well as the Theravada, and also at the doctrinal evolution of the philosophical system. So he looks, for example, at very important philosophical doctrines, one of which he calls the Samayavada, which is the Abhisamayavada, which is the teaching on what actually happens when you realize the truth. Okay, so at the moment of enlightenment, what actually is going on there? So this is one of the things that the Abhidhamma theorists debated. Another one. It's called Studies in Abhidharma Literature and the Origins of Buddhist Philosophical Systems. I'll leave these downstairs for a few days if anyone wants to have a look. Well, for example, at the time of getting enlightened, does that take a long time or a short time? What actual mental qualities are present at that time? What is the experience like? These kinds of questions. So they were trying to see that one of the issues that the Abhidhamma has to do is to equate this very extraordinary mind state with ordinary psychology to show how our ordinary psychological analysis then changes or shifts. Yeah, yeah. So that's a, that. So that's very, very useful for understanding those things. This one, Legend and Cult of Upagupta, you should all read. Excellent. Do yourself a favour. If you really want to understand, this book is the most, I think, the best book ever written for understanding in like an organic way how Buddhist culture emerges and how it interacts with, say, Buddhist ideas and philosophy on the one hand, the practices of the sages and the saints and the forest monastics, and how that interacts with personal lay devotion, mythology and doctrine and all of those things, and how that's evolved from its roots in ancient India down to present-day folk customs in Southeast Asia, and fascinating on every level. So it's really very highly recommended. Author, John S. Strong. This one, another inviting title, Sarvastivada Buddhist Scholasticism. I know you're just rushing to read this one. A series of articles on different aspects of Sarvastivada in history. So Sarvastivada is something that you'll hear a lot in talking about Buddhist history, and was by far the most influential of the early Buddhist schools in ancient India, both in terms of the number of texts that it's produced. We have far more Sarvastivadin texts than of any other early Buddhist school, apart, of course, from the Theravadin, but also in terms of their influence on Buddhist philosophy as a whole. So this is an excellent modern study on different aspects of that. So quite a specialised and difficult study, but Williman, Dason, Cox. I'll put these downstairs, you can have a look at them there. Sorry, what? Sarvastivada means everything exists. It's from the word sarva, plus asti. Everything, all, exists. Plus vada is a doctrine. So the Sarvastivada. The doctrine, or the vada literally means like a doctrine, but it's so Sarvastivada can be used in two senses: as the name of the doctrine, but also the name of the school which follows that doctrine. So usually it's used as the name of the school, so the school which teaches the doctrine that all exists. So the basic idea is that the Dhammas exist in the past, present, and future. Mula Sarvastivada is. Mula Sarvastivada means original. Mula means root. So it means the original Sarvastivada. And, of course, the somewhat ironic thing is that you don't call yourself an original until there's some kind of competition, right? I mean, if you just are the original, then you're just a Sarvastivada and there's no problem about it, right?
So, no, but it can be that there was Sarvastivada, and then some argued some new idea, and then they branched off, and then they were like putting themselves the original.
They were calling themselves the original, yeah. But the name must have arisen after there was a dispute.
The name was after the split.
So the name Mula Sarvastivada only appears quite late in the text, around 7th century. And so there's an ongoing scholarly debate about actually when they emerged, and whether they really are the original Sarvastivadins, or whether they just call themselves that, and so on and so forth. Well, obviously claiming to be conservatives. But I work on the ideas followed by Fravalna, which is that Mula Sarvastivada, in fact, is the original community that was in Mathura, and that what we call usually Sarvastivada is also called the Vaibhashikas. And that was a community which became established in Kashmir. And they were originally part of the same school, but later developed independently. But there's really very little evidence. So in all of these things, we're really struggling. There's so little evidence. I mean, there's reams and reams and reams of texts discussing all these abstruse doctrinal points. And very little that gives us an idea of actually who these people were and where they lived and what they did and so on.
Why is it Sarvastivada is the most influential?
Yeah, again, an interesting question. And somewhat peculiar. I mean, the doctrine, Sarvastivada, is a somewhat peculiar and obscure doctrine. There's no doubt a combination of interesting factors which affected that. If you, in this book, The Legend and Cult of Upagupta, maybe gives some hint to that. Upagupta was probably himself not a Sarvastivadin. It probably didn't exist in his time. But he was certainly co-opted by the Sarvastivadins. And so they, I think, were very successful both in terms of developing a sort of a popular Buddhist literature, lots of jatakas and stories and things like that, and also in developing the philosophy to a very advanced level. They also probably sort of went on the wings of the political movements at the time. They were the Sarvastivadin headquarters was in Kashmir, and about 1st to 2nd century, there was a very strong Buddhist king there called Kanishka. And he was the Sarvastivadin, so he was like a second Ashoka in some ways. And so he was a patron of the Sarvastivadins. So it seems that was also a major factor. I mean, other schools were also very influential. When Xuanzang went there in the 7th century, there was actually more Pugalovadins than anything else, which is the ones who teach the doctrine of the Pugala, or the person. But, you know, we know very little about them. There's very few of their texts that remain and so on, so it's hard for us to actually say very much meaningful about them. Sorry?
Not meaning to be tricky, but why is it important to...
Now for something completely different. Okay, sorry?
Why is it important to read this?
Why? Can you think of any reasons? Anyone else? Why is it important to read these books or study these things?
These particular books or in general?
I think it's good to basically understand how people function. They work. Basically, people are starting. How ideas evolve and then you can't accept it as being right.
It's a very arbitrary process. Sometimes the ideas are win acceptance because they're intrinsically plausible, but other times for completely irrelevant factors. I mean, the basic idea, the basic reason is that we should know something about Buddhism. I know so what we're studying here is what people who were Buddhists in the past, what they did, what they thought, how they practiced, and what are the issues, conflicts, developments and so on in Buddhism. Many of the things which are issues today follow on from the issues which were developed in these periods. Okay, and so by understanding these things, then we will understand much better a lot of the issues that happen today. Just give you one obvious example of the time when we were in Hamburg and there was a suggestion of the idea that ordination, when you took ordination in a particular school, that there was an avijñapti rupa which arose in the heart base of the person who took the ordination. Now, if I say that to you guys, most people, if they haven't studied it, that's really meaningless. But when Bhikkhu Bodhi and I heard that, we immediately understood exactly what they were saying, because we studied the Abhidhamma texts and so on, so we knew what these concepts referred to. And that was a genuine argument which was considered in the case of ordaining bhikkhuni. So it's not something that's just locked away in a text. It's something which is real and present in people's minds and which influences the ongoing debate. And that's very far from being an isolated case. I mean, for example, in Theravada, we have discussions, for example, on Samatha and Vipassana, and everyone has their different opinions about that. Now, we can look at the suttas and read what the suttas say. When we listen to modern-day Theravadins discussing this, you'll constantly hear them referring to ideas like, say, Upachara Samadhi, Kanaka Samadhi, and so on, which are not found in the suttas. So it's by studying this later literature that we understand what those terms mean, where do they come from, what was the kind of the context and so on that they arose. Again, it helps us to put everything in perspective. Or again, say when we're discussing with say Mahayana bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and they have, you know, various ideas. They talk about the bodhisattva precepts, for example. And so we study things, and then we find out, oh, what was the conditions? Where did that come from? Yeah, so it just helps understanding all of those things. So this is another excellent book simply called Indian Philosophy by Richard King, and this is really an excellent book. I think you read it, right? Yeah. It's a really good one. Very clear, and discusses a lot of the important philosophical issues from the perspective of a Westerner who's interested to understand these things as they were practiced and understood in India. And I may use this as a teaching text in some of the future weeks, but that's highly recommended. And
it's a really good kind of background of what Buddhism in the background of Hinduism.
Yeah.
Like, so you see that it's not all just up in the air, it's very much embedded in what was there.
How Buddhist ideas are responding to their own context. Which again is one of the great problems, is that all of these things were responding to a particular context, and we're not aware of what that context is. So we're trying to get to know that. Now this particular one, also called, well, this one's called Indian Buddhism, imaginatively, and with an almost unreadable font on the front. But this is like the classic A.K. Water, A.K. Water's Indian Buddhism. This was written, originally written 1970, but he revised it a number of times up until about 2000. I think Water passed away a few years ago, and he was one of the few truly great scholars of Buddhism, and one of the few who is really fluent and conversant with the Buddhist texts of all periods and all languages. And this consists almost entirely of original work based on the original texts themselves. He refers to and cites Lamott's work on Indian Buddhism quite a lot, but in some ways this is better than Lamott. I haven't got Lamott here now. I think we looked at that last year, but Lamott's work. Lamott's work is much more of a collection of discrete studies on things who brings together all of the sources and things like that. So it's very good as a reference work, but it's not so good to actually read to get a coherent idea of what was happening. And the other thing is this studies all of the later period as well, which Lamott doesn't. So this goes right up from the origins of the Indian history right up to the disappearance of Buddhism from India in the last pages. It gives a description of the destruction of Buddhism in India. And along the way, it looks at the emergence of all the different schools of Buddhism, emergence of the Mahayana and the later schools of logical philosophy, and the Tantrayana and things like that. So... classic. Do yourself a favour. And this one is another interesting one, which also gives some very worthwhile perspectives, called Philosophies of India by Heinrich Zimmer. And Heinrich Zimmer was a scholar of India and a Sanskritist who passed away, I think, shortly after the Second World War or so, and left a bunch of unfinished manuscripts which were collated and edited by Joseph Campbell. And so this is a somewhat earlier sort of period of European history, but he gives a lot of examples of the kind of philosophies apart from and as well as the Buddhist philosophy. So it goes into some detail in Jain philosophy, but also it's also very useful because he goes into what he calls the philosophies of time rather than the philosophies of the timeless, like Buddhism and so on. The philosophy he calls the philosophies of eternity. Perhaps dispute that thing, but the philosophies of time is, number one, the philosophy of success, which is things like theory of war, political geometry and so on. The philosophy of pleasure, the Kama Sutra and so on. And the philosophy of duty, the notion of the caste and the stages of life and so on. So these were a lot of the worldly philosophies which influenced people in ancient India in terms of their politics and social attitudes and so on. And so he discusses them, so that's also useful from that perspective. Okay. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. We'll see how we go in terms of time. Yeah.
Well, just thinking, I mean, in our life, you know, you come across people from Vietnam,
It'd be interesting to know more. It's not my area of expertise, so it would be very interesting to do something on the history of Buddhism in the different countries, in Thailand and Burma and China and so on. So look, we'll see how we go, and at the moment I'm not sure whether we will. I'm kind of thinking that this course will be Indian Buddhism, mainly, partly because I know much less about the history of Buddhism in the other countries, but maybe we could look at seeing if we can find somebody who's got better knowledge in that area that could come and give us some teachings on that. Yeah, that would be probably a good thing to look out for. Okay, so just kind of a reminder here on the right, the dark blue area is the area of Ashoka's empire. Sorry? Not it wasn't in Sri Lanka. Yeah. The dark blue area?
Oh, it's purple.
Oh, is it purple? Is it purple?
It can be.
Well, the darker area anyway. They're described here as tributaries, so southern India and Sri Lanka. And over here, Suvarnabhumi maybe. So it's huge. It's probably quite, because a lot of here is up in Pakistan and Bangladesh and so on, so it's probably quite a lot bigger than the modern Indian state, and probably by far the biggest empire in the world at that time, I would imagine. It's a bit difficult to say. The Greek Empire would have been bigger at its height, but it also sort of broken up by that stage. But much bigger than anything like Egypt or something like that. So, of course, it only lasted for a few generations, gradually began to break up. Okie dokie. So, what we might do just for the remainder of today's class, rather than getting into anything too heavy, then it might just give a little bit more of the history following King Ashoka, and just taking it from Wikipedia for the time being. So from the time of the Sunga dynasty, Sunga Empire. Sunga dynasty was about 185 to 73 BCE, established in 185, about 50 years after Ashoka's death. After assassinating King Brihadrata, the last of the Mauryan rulers, so the Mauryan dynasty is from the word meaning peacock, and this was the Ashoka's dynasty. The military commander-in-chief, Pushyamitra Sunga, took the throne. Buddhist religious scriptures such as the Ashokavadana, which we have a translation of, if anyone's interested. The Ashokavadana is the biography of King Ashoka according to the Sarvasivadin school. Ashokavadana alleged that Pushyamitra, an orthodox Brahmin, was hostile towards Buddhists and persecuted the Buddhist faith. Buddhists wrote that he destroyed monasteries and killed monks. 84,000 Buddhist stupas which had been built by Ashoka were destroyed. And 100 gold coins were offered for the head of each Buddhist monk. In addition, Buddhist sources allege that a large number of Buddhist monasteries and viharas were converted to Hindu temples in such places as Nalanda, Bodh Gaya, Sarnath, or Mathura. And those accusations and that description of Pushyamitra is found quite broadly in a number of texts. It's not just an isolated statement. Following Ashoka's sponsorship of Buddhism, it's possible that Buddhist institutions fell on harder times under the Sunghas, but no evidence of active persecution has been noted. Lamotte observes, to judge from the documents, Pushyamitra must be acquitted through lack of proof. Another eminent historian, Romila Tapar, points to archaeological evidence which suggests the contrary to the claim that Pushyamitra was fanatical anti-Buddhist and he never actually destroyed 84,000 stupas as claimed by Buddhist works. Tapar stresses that the Buddhist accounts are probably hyperbolic renditions of Pushyamitra's attack of the Mauryas and merely reflect the frustration of the Buddhist religious figures to the decline of the importance of their religion by the Sunghas. There's probably a bit of both. It's difficult to know whether there was any active persecution at that time. If there was, it was certainly an unusual incident. It's extremely unusual to find religious persecution in ancient India. And I guess, given that it's so rare, then perhaps even mild incidents of persecution or something might be regarded as treated very dramatically. But certainly the scholarly consensus is that the Buddhist texts are at least an exaggeration of what happened. Okay, then the next article here talks about the Greco-Buddhist interaction, which of course is a very fascinating topic. In the areas west of the Indian subcontinent, neighbouring Greek kingdoms have been in place in Bactria, today's northern Afghanistan, since the time of the conquest of Alexander the Great around 326 BCE. First the Seleucids from about 323 BCE, then the Greco-Bactrian kingdom from about 250 BCE. So here's Bactria. Doesn't give it a tour, but not a good idea of where it is. Here's the Greco-Bactrian kingdom. So also quite a significant thing, a big kingdom. It's not as big as the Mauryan Empire, but still pretty big. So this is.
These are the Aryans from Arya.
Huh? The Aryans are from Arya.
Yeah, it's the Aryans.
Where's Arya?
Kingdom. It says Russian Kingdom Arya.
Arya. Oh, I don't know. That's not where the Aryans come from, anyway. But I'm not sure what that means.
Oh, that's right. That's modern Iran. So what period was this kingdom?
The Bactrian kingdom. 250 to 125 BCE. And then the expansion of the Greco-Bactrians established the Indo-Greek kingdom, which lasted to about 10 CE. So it's an even later one. The Indo-Greek kingdom. Just about 100 BC. So 100 BC, if this is map's correct, then following the Mauryan Empire, then India's sort of broken back up into its various parts, which was very much the way from then on, and had been before Ashoka, that the idea of India as a unified country has actually been a reality very, very rarely in history. Almost all the time, it's looked something like that. So India actually in history is more like, considered more like Europe, for example. It's a region which has a certain cultural history in common, but with separate nationalities and states and separate languages and all of these things. Very rarely unified. Only King Ashoka did it. And then later on, some of the Muslim kings did it, and then of course the British did it. But Ashoka was probably the only sort of local who actually created it. It was why the Ashoka was taken as the emblem for the modern Indian state. But I'm not at all an expert in this kind of period of history, so I'm just sort of having a general kind of look at it to see what happened here. The glucose. So I don't know how much detail we want to go into the sort of secular history of the thing, but it just is interesting to know this kind of period of interaction between Indian and Greek culture. It's not a small thing, and it's kind of not an isolated incident or something. So here we have sort of Greek coins from the area, Greek sculpture, and so on. Probable Greek soldier in near China. And of course some of the edicts of King Ashoka are bilingual in Greek and Aramaic.
So that Greek, Aramaic and
the Magadhi or Gandhari or something. But this one, it just seems to be, there's different ones, but this one they've got here just seems to be just Greek and Aramaic, doesn't have any Indic tongue in it. In Kandahar, where's Kandahar? In Afghanistan.
He's
staying out in the old caves. Yeah. So a very strong presence there. Here we have. Yes, that's a very Greek Buddha. It's like the one.
You wanted the one that the Buddha.
That's a good question. Yeah, probably looks like he just about can. Yeah. Yeah, he's got. It's probably right. He's got his extended arms there. Yeah. And so this one is the Drachma. Of Mananda's King Milinda. So of course one of the books in the Pali, the later books in the Pali canon is the Questions of King Milinda, King Mananda. And so there's the coin, these coins. And here's a coin of Mananda with the Buddhist Dhamma wheel on it. And here's a... we should do one session on the Milinda Panha, but he was a Greek king in the region who apparently converted to Buddhism and has a sort of extensive dialogue of his which has been preserved. So that's something we'll have a look at that in one of the later classes. Yeah. So here's again one of his coins, again with a Dhamma wheel on there. And here's, I mentioned before, Kanishka and the Kusan Empire. And here he has, you can see here, you can even recognize the writing as a picture of the Buddha, and it says Bodho, B-O-D-D-O. Yeah. It's cute, isn't it?
Working out the chronology and the name. Key to the language. So it's a British, I think it's numismology or something.
Because the coins, they last a long time and people keep them.
Yeah, and they've got the keys.
Yeah, yeah.
And they...
So that's pretty, I think that's very cute, isn't it? Bodo. Yes. Most of the Buddhist history books would discuss it. It's a bit of an area of speciality for Mark Allen at Sydney Uni, and he's working on the Gandhari texts which are found in that region. He gave a presentation at not this year's but last year's ABS conference on that, the interaction of the Greek and Buddhist interaction. One of the curious things about this. One of the sort of things is that you have such obvious and straightforward examples of Greek and Greek influence on Buddhist art, so much so that it's been seriously argued that the very idea of a Buddha image was a Greek invention, because some of the earliest ones are this form as the Greek form, although there's also sort of equally early ones which are further down near Mathura, which so it's a bit of a debate there whether the Greek ones were earlier and the Indians got the idea from the Greeks, or whether they were invented simultaneously, or what exactly happened there. But certainly you have this very straightforward, there's no doubt at all that there was a huge cross-fertilization between Buddhist ideas and Greek sculpture and so on. But you don't see a similar obvious cross-fertilization in the philosophies. And something like the Melinda Panha is very surprising, because there's precisely nothing about Greek philosophy in it. It's entirely questions about Buddhism and Buddhist philosophy, which might have been said by Buddhists from anywhere. There's no Buddhist texts that discuss Plato and Aristotle and so on and so forth. And so that's kind of a curious feature of this. And there's an ongoing scholarly debate about whether there was in fact any interaction or influence from the West in philosophy and so on. We have a book downstairs which I didn't bring up, but it's called The Shape of Ancient Thought, and that argues very extensively that there was long-lasting and important cross-fertilization between the West and India. But that's other scholars take a different point of view on that.
The general public, or the people, the traders, the corporate world, you know, the people that, the sort of people that might be, you know, traveling to establishing their trade and corporations or whatever. And I think because Greek there doesn't necessarily mean.
Very true, and that would be one of the main arguments for that. Yeah, a different kind of social strata. I mean, it is curious. So, for example, Alexander was there, and he was Aristotle's student.
Buddhism is more than just philosophy.
The Greeks sort of said that their philosophies was more than just a philosophy as well. Oh, definitely. Yeah.
All of them.
Well, I would think the majority of them. Yeah, it's much more of a later development that it becomes such a scholastic discipline. I mean, for them, it really influenced. I mean, the Pythagoreans had their kind of quasi-monastic communities, and Euripides and so on. They set up all these things. Sorry?
He was just walking the market.
Plato, yeah.
Yeah.
So Socrates, yeah. He'd walk the markets and talk with
people. He wasn't in any academia whatsoever.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's clearly part of the explanation. I still have to say that, you know, I mean, even Socrates himself was a soldier. I mean, he was in foreign campaigns. So it was obviously quite a bit earlier. But I personally, I find it quite curious that there is. I mean, there's a few references in the Greek literature to Indian texts, but nothing, no real kind of serious.
Sorry? Maybe because there was no text in India, it was more spoken. Even if there was influence, and if there was a dialogue, it's just gone.
Yeah, could be.
They wouldn't memorize. They memorized the suttas. They memorized the Buddha's teachings.
Yeah.
They didn't necessarily memorize every dialogue or debate they had with people, especially from the outside. Okay, they kept the dialogues with the Brahmins.
Yeah.
That was essential.
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
But these were the people from outside the Greek kingdom. Not like the Greeks come in and visit many gods.
No, but the idea of Socrates and Plato is just yes. Well, it would be very boring.
It's interesting, but there, for example, there are Greek amphitheatres. So they had Greek drama in those areas.
Yeah, but again, what you see is the amphitheatre, structure.
Yeah, yeah.
If you didn't know that means that there was, you know, drama there, then how would you know that there was drama if it's not? It's only just the stones that survive and
If
you have oral culture rather than textual one,
yeah.
And you know, the stones only take that
story, yeah. Is there any partial story?
The fact is that we don't have evidence, but I wouldn't say, you know, that means 100% sure that there was no dialogue.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's the evidence of it.
That's the debate. I mean, I was quite impressed with some of the arguments in the book, The Shape of Ancient Thought. So, I mean, he was arguing, for example, that Nagarjuna was influenced by some of the Greek philosophers. So, I mean, I certainly think there may be something there. Okie dokie. So, in areas west, in Bactria and so on, since the time of Alexander the Great, there was the Greco-Bactrian kingdom. From about 250, the Greco-Bactrian king Demetrius I invaded India in 880 BCE, as far as Pataliputta, of course being King Ashoka's capital, establishing an Indo-Greek kingdom that was to last in various parts of northern India until the end of the 1st century BCE. Okay, so, yeah, Buddhism flourished under the Indo-Greek kings, and it's been suggested that their invasion of India was intended to show their support for the Mauryan Empire and to protect the Buddhist faith from the alleged religious persecutions of the Sungas. Maybe. One of the most famous Indo-Greek kings is Nananda, reigned 160 to 135 BCE. He apparently converted to Buddhism and is presented in the Mahayana tradition as one of the great benefactors of the faith, on a par with King Ashoka or the later Kushan king Kanishka. Mananda's coins bear the mention Saviour King in Greek, and sometimes designs of the eight-spoked wheel. Direct cultural exchange is also suggested by the dialogue of the Melinda Panha between Mananda and the monk Nagasena about 160 BCE. Upon his death, the honour of sharing his remains was claimed by the cities under his rule, and they were enshrined in stupas. In parallel with the historic Buddha, several of Mananda's Indo-Greek successors inscribed the mentioned follower of the Dharma in the Kharoshthi script on their coins and depict themselves on their divinities, forming the Vitaraka Mudra. The interaction between Greek and Buddhist cultures may have had some influence on the evolution of Mahayana, as the faith developed its sophisticated philosophical approach and a man-god treatment of the Buddha somewhat reminiscent of Hellenic gods. Sounds a bit artificial to me. Hellenic gods are... Yeah, the Hellenic gods are pretty different from the Mahayana Buddha, my goodness. It's only around the time that the first anthropomorphic representations of the Buddha are found, often in realistic Greco-Buddhist style. And a quote from Boardman, one might regard the classical influences, including the general idea of representing a man-god in this purely human form, which was of course well familiar in the West, and it is very likely that the example of Westerners' treatment of their gods was indeed an important factor in the innovation. Okay, so this is about the adoption of the Buddha image as such.
So the Skandhara, that period, is that... Sorry,
that earlier? These Bactrian kingdoms and so on, this is in Gandhara, yeah.
So is Gandhara part of it?
Let's just see the map. They say, that just in one of the etymologies here, They said that Gandhara was a possible etymology of Kandahar. It was actually the same word. Maybe, maybe not. But yeah, that's the Gandharan region. Where are we? Right. So, and then from there, from the Bactrian region, Buddhism then expanded through Central Asia. Buddhist gold coin from India was found in northern Afghanistan at the archaeological site of Tilya Tepe and dated to the 1st century CE. On the reverse, it depicts a lion with a Nandi Pada, a delightful foot, with the Kharoshthi legend, the lion who dispelled fear. On the obverse, an almost naked man wearing only Hellenistic, whatever that is, chlamys, and a Pedastus hat, an iconography similar to that of Hermes or Mercury, rolls a Buddhist wheel. There you go. We have Hermes rolling the Dhammachakra. The legend in Kharoshthi reads Dhammachakra Pravattako, the one who turned the wheel of the Dhamma. It's been suggested this may be an early representation of the Buddha. Oh, that's quite fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't think there are any from that early. No. See, it's before at the time of Ashoka, there wasn't anything. And I think after Ashoka, I don't think you'd find Hindu sculptures from that early period. We can just we can.
So the Hindu sculptures you think were.
I would say very likely, yeah. Let's just have a look at that. Back to the Indus Valley. So first second century BCE is the life of the Buddha and so on, and Darwin Greek influence, Afghanistan and so on. So it's all talking about the Buddhist as the earliest, the sculpture. So all of these kind of Hindu styles are all, they're all later. And you can see that from them. I mean, they're all Hindu stuff. It's all very, very sophisticated styles.
Then evolved its own kind of style, but...
they probably wouldn't be that old. Yeah, they probably... They probably would be nearly a couple of thousand years old, so maybe like second, third century, something like that. I'm just trying to have a look at the Mathura is also famous. I'm just trying to find some examples of the early Mathuran image. Images of the Buddha, the other being Gandhara, human images of the Buddha. Began to appear approximately the same time in both centres in the 1st century AD, but can be distinguished from one another as the Gandharan images are very clearly Greco-Roman inspiration. The Mathura figures produced in Mathura more closely resemble some of the older Indian male fertility gods and have shorter, curlier hair and lighter, more translucent robes. So there's more... Yes, so they would be like things like, say, you'd find on the Buddhist... say in Sanchi and things like that, where you find a lot of representations of the deities and so on. So again, I'm not sure if there's any specifically Hindu sources of that, but I'm just trying to find a Mathura Buddha image. I don't really have any. Bhikkhu Buddha's Tart. Yeah, the same one again. I'm trying to find the... doesn't actually have... I'm trying to just do a search. So here's some examples. So obviously you can see there's much less Greek influence there. So yeah, just giving a different idea of the different styles. So because this is what the discussion is about, whether the originated in Gandhara, moved down and became Indianized, or whether moved the other way, or whether it was independently adopted in different areas. Okay, so coming down further. Okay. So the rise of the Mahayana, rise of Mahayana Buddhism from 1st century BCE. Was accompanied by complex political changes in northwestern India. The Indo-Greek kingdoms were gradually overwhelmed and their culture assimilated by the Indo-Scythians and then the... Some Chinese person want to attempt that one for me? Weizhi? Something like that?
need to? What do you reckon? We drew founded the Kushan Empire from around 12 BCE. The Kushans were supporters of Buddhism. So we're still up in that same area, the sort of Gandhara, Afghanistan area. Were supportive of Buddhism, and a fourth Buddhist council, according to this tradition, was convened by the Kushan Emperor Kanishka around 100 CE at Jalandhar, or in Kashmir, and is usually associated with the formal rise of Mahayana Buddhism and its succession from Theravada. That is, I wouldn't accept that explanation. The fourth council, it was almost certainly a meeting of the Sarvastivadins and involved the redaction of the Sarvastivadin scriptures and so on. I don't think it had anything to do with Mahayana. Theravada Buddhism does not recognize the authenticity of this council, and it is sometimes called the Council of Heretical Monks. That's a load of twaddle, actually, should be deleted. The new form of Buddhism was characterized by an almost godlike treatment of the Buddha, by the idea that all beings have a Buddha nature and should aspire to Buddhahood, and by syncretism due to the various cultural influences within northwestern India and the Kushan Empire. So we'll be looking in more detail at the origins of the Mahayana and so on, but just to say that the origin of the Mahayana is very disputed and complex and difficult topic, and it has been a major subject of research in Western academic studies for the last 20 years. And so a lot of the ideas which were believed earlier have now been abandoned. Some of the ideas here, yeah, so this idea of the Fourth Council and so on, I wouldn't agree with that. There almost certainly was a council under Kanishka. I think he probably did sponsor a council, but the council didn't have anything to do with that, with the Mahayana. I think what the council did was to formulate what's called the Vaibhasha, which is the basically the commentarial Abhidhamma system of the local Kashmiri branch of the Sarvastivadins, and that became more or less the orthodoxy against which a lot of the later movements kind of measured itself and tried to refute and so on. So Vaibhasha still exists in Chinese translation. It's a huge text in Chinese, huge Abhidhamma commentary. Say Vasubandhu, Nagarjuna, and so on.
So, no.
Yeah, but what they're saying here, they're saying here is that it's the Mahayana was taking part. That's one thing that was that was basically just a later Mahayana polemical claim to say that they were actually taking part in there, and there was the formal schism there, and anything that didn't happen. Yeah. Okay, so two fourth councils. So this is another little piece of Buddhist history. The fourth council said to have been, so this is the fourth council according to the Sarvastivadin tradition, the northern traditions, convened in the reign of Kushan Emperor Kanishka around 100 CE. Theravadin Buddhism had its own fourth council in Sri Lanka about 200 years earlier, in which the Pali Canon was written down in toto for the first time. Therefore, there are two fourth councils, one in Sri Lanka and one in Kashmir. Okay, so that's very important to remember that, and when you're reading things, if they refer to the fourth council, you have to clearly know exactly which one they're referring to. It said the fourth council of Kashmir, Kanishka, gathered 500 monks headed by Vasumitra, partly, it seems, to compile extensive commentaries on the Abhidharma, which is what we call the Vibhasha, although it's possible that some editorial work was carried out in the existing canon itself. What may also have happened at that time was the translation, or at least signifying like the movement of the adoption of Sanskrit as a canonical language for the canon. Allegedly, during the council, there were altogether 300,000 verses and over 9 million statements compiled, and it took 12 years to complete. The main fruit of this council was a compilation of the vast commentary known as the Mahavibhasha, an extensive compendium and reference work on a portion of the Sarvastivadin Abhidharma. So the Mahavibhasha is kind of used in a way similar to, say, the Visuddhimagga or something in the Theravadin tradition. Scholars believe that it was also around this time that a significant change was made in the language of the Sarvastivadin canon by converting an earlier Prakrit version into Sanskrit. Though this exchange was probably effected without significant loss of integrity to the canon, this event was of particular significance since Sanskrit was the sacred language of Brahmanism in India and was also being used by other thinkers, regardless of their specific religious or philosophical allegiance, thus enabling a far wider audience to gain access to Buddhist ideas and practices. Maybe. It's also, even though I said it myself a little while ago, it's also somewhat dubious to say that the texts were translated into Sanskrit this early. There's not much evidence for the actual existence or widespread use of Sanskrit as a language until quite a few hundred years later. So I'd see more this is more as being a marker towards that rather than there being strong evidence that the texts were actually translated into Sanskrit. Nevertheless, just about all of the existing Sarvastivadin scriptures that we have from in the Indic version are in classical Sanskrit, more or less. That's right, yeah. Yes. So that's the Dharmaguptaka scriptures tend to be in the Gandhara, which is like a Prakrit. Most of the Sarvastivadin stuff is all in classical Sanskrit with some influence from the Prakrits. And the Mahasangika stuff is in hybrid Sanskrit, which is basically a mixture of Sanskrit and sort of more Pali-like kind of form. Yeah. It's quite complex. And obviously one of the problems has been that we've preserved the text, tended to preserve the text from this area solely because of climate. It's drier. And so all the texts from the mainland India itself just don't exist. The manuscripts just don't last that long. There's quite limited knowledge of the languages used by the other Buddhist schools. Yeah. Scholars believe, blah, 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 so we've done that bit. Okay, so for this reason, there was a growing tendency among Buddhist scholars in India thereafter to write their commentaries and treatises in Sanskrit. Many of the early schools, however, such as Theravada, never switched to Sanskrit, partly because the Buddha explicitly forbade translations of his discourses into Sanskrit because it was an elitist religious language, like Latin wasn't in Europe in earlier times. So that's referring to a reference in the Pali Canon and other Vinayas where the Buddha said you shouldn't put the texts in chandas, and not being quite clear what chandas was, chandas usually being a term for a particular kind of Sanskrit verse. He wanted his monks to use a local language instead. Okay, so Sakaya Niruti in one's own language. He said you should learn Dhamma in one's own language. The language could be understood by all. Over time, however, the language of the Theravadin scriptures, Pali, became a scholarly or elitist language as well. So, of course, this is always the problem. And you had a linguistic problem in Sri Lanka, where you had the canon brought over in Pali, which was fairly similar to the Sri Lankan dialect at the time. Commentaries were made in the Sri Lankan language, and part of the purpose of the commentaries was to explain the Pali for those not familiar with it. But as time went on, the Sri Lankan language itself evolved, and they could no longer speak natively the actual commentarial Sri Lankan. So you then had the colloquial Sri Lankan, the commentarial or literary Sri Lankan, and the Pali. So you had to learn three languages. So that at that point, that's when they retranslated the commentaries back into Pali. So since then, they've kept basically the two traditions of Pali and then whatever the local language is.
What was the original?
Hard to say. Would have been what they call a Prakrit. So Prakrit being essentially colloquial tongue. What exact Prakrit is hard to say. Probably a variety of them, but obviously you'd look to the local languages of those areas.
So does Prakrit just mean local?
Yeah. So Prakrit. Prakrit. And that's just Sanskrit. So Krit means made. And so Krit means made. Sanskrit. Sanskrit means artificial. Official or like almost like perfected, and Prakrit means sort of natural, yeah, natural.
So
Prakrit is used it's used in different ways, but mostly it's used as a generic term for the colloquial language of India.
Pali is a semi-Prakrit. Pali is a Prakrit with certain artificial tendencies in it. And so, of course, the difference is that, like, the natural language or colloquial languages are very messy. They're full of kind of weird bits and, you know, irregularities and so on, whereas Sanskrit has tried to remove all of those and put everything in a perfect system. Exactly, yeah. So classical Sanskrit is precisely a frozen language. It's formally identical today as it was 2,000 years ago. It's also frozen in linguistic and grammatical conventions, which were already archaic at the time that it was formed. So Sanskrit preserves a lot of archaic features, which as languages evolved, that they dropped out. For example, like more grammars and more grammatical categories and so on. So that's actually why it's very complex. So Mahayana expansion from the 1st to the 10th century, from that point on, and in the space of a few centuries, Mahayana was to flourish and spread in the east from India to Southeast Asia, towards the north, Central Asia, China, Korea, and finally to Japan in 538 CE. So you have basically two movements of Buddhism, as you can, as depicted on this map here. And, Buddhism kind of, it sort of went, as we've seen, it went very strongly to the West in the early period, but then was kind of limited in the extent to which would go. It sort of, as I say, sort of bounced around the corner and went over to China down the Silk Road. And although, you know, to a certain extent was established in modern-day Iranian region and so on, never really spread west, whereas the easternmost spread was of course very successful, and so spread over the land route to China, from China to Korea and Japan, and then down influencing Vietnam, but also on the sea routes. This route represents the direct transmission from India, mainland India, into what they call Suvarnabhumi, current day Burma and Thailand, and then influencing the Khmer and Vietnam and so on. And then also down here to what they're calling Sriwijaya, which was a very influential empire in the Indonesian region. As well as going that way, it also went from Sri Lanka, and probably from India as well, through the trade routes up to China. So you had like a sea route that actually went all the way up to China, obviously stopping over in these places. So it was actually the different forms of early Buddhism that spread to these areas first, and probably for all of the Southeast Asian region, there would have been a mix of both early schools of Buddhism and later the Mahayana becoming more influential, but probably in these regions, hard to say, but mostly the early schools would have been the most predominant. Whereas in China, it seems that China was actually the first region where Mahayana became established as the predominant religious force. And while Mahayana was still a fairly minority movement in India, so say 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries AD, it had already become the mainstream and most influential movement in China itself. India. Okay. So now after the end of the Kushans, so remember the Kushan up in Kashmir, in Kanishka, and they ended what time? It's just 375, so that's quite a long time, yeah? Kushan Empire, so from 375. Buddhism flourished in India during the dynasty of the Guptas, 4th to 6th century. Mahayana centers of learning were established, especially at Nalanda in northeastern India. I don't think it's accurate to describe Nalanda as a Mahayana center of learning. It was a Buddhist center of learning, which would have included scholars from all the schools, which was to become the largest and most influential Buddhist university for many centuries, with famous teachers such as Nagarjuna. The Gupta style of Buddhist art became very influential from Southeast Asia to China as the faith was spreading there. And the Gupta artwork is
Where are they going? Yeah, well, let's just have a bit of a look. Try to find the Gupta. Here's the Guptas. So is the Gupta Rajavamsa?
So were the Guptas there at the same time?
No, but after the Kushans.
After the Kushans.
Yeah. So also up there in the west.
The Kushans didn't come that far.
Not that far south and east, that's right, yeah. So Gupta is more of a native Indian empire. And often regarded, as it says here, as the golden age of India, quite a stable and peaceful empire for the time. And some of the Gupta artwork is, I think, some of the probably the greatest of the Indian artwork and the Buddhist art. Let's see if we have any Gupta images here. Doesn't have them. Well, yeah. Oops. Let's try saying Buddha images. Yeah, so this is a very famous one in the Indian Museum. So it's one of my favourite Buddha heads of all. So that's, you know, you can see a very, very refined, subtle sculpture that was going on. You see much, quite different from the much more humanistic kind of heavy style from the Greek sculptures has become now very, very spiritualized and quite abstract, very beautiful lines and so on. And this is another, this is the one that was copied for the image in Dhammalamara. Any others? Yeah, these are devas, yeah. And devas giving a present.
Yeah, in fact, the Dhammalamara one's got much more devas.
Right, you
think?
No.
Is
there
any Buddha statue that the Buddha had no hair?
I don't know.
No hair? Is it from the very beginning he always had that funky
hair? Yeah. I always had some kind of version of the funky funky hairdo, yeah. Yeah. So? Ashamed of his hair.
Oh.
I'm
not sure if I ever seen one that directly
shaved. So I think like in this period that you know, because the previous ones, both the Greek ones, the ones and also the Mataran ones were you know, quite heavy and quite kind of masculine and so on. So this Gupta period is much softer, much more spiritualized. Yes. Anyway, so just give you some idea of how this is changing over the years. So yeah, so the Gupta period, yeah, in some ways the kind of the golden age. Pretty much so, yeah. 320 to 550.
What does Gupta actually mean?
Guarded.
Guarded?
Yeah. And I just want to see about the, it's got a discussion of the religion here. It doesn't talk much about the religion. It's certainly Buddhism was flourishing at that time. I'm not sure whether all of the Gupta kings were themselves Buddhists. Often, you know, often it's not such an issue, and you find that within the dynasty, that they'll just support all the religions. That was kind of the mainstream thing, and of course, obviously, if they were personally Buddhist, you can expect they'd give greater support, but it doesn't really, most of them, of course, were kings, first and foremost. But you often also find, from the archaeology, we found that actually quite a few cases that you'd have the king would be recorded as a Hindu king, and his wife would be supported as giving a lot of donations to the monasteries, Buddhist monasteries. So there's obviously this is quite mixed. Indian Buddhism had weakened in the 6th century following the White Hun invasions and the Mihir Pulas persecution. I'm not quite sure what that was. But possibly also weakening because of internal development. Xuanzang reports in his travels across India in the 7th century of Buddhism being popular in Andhra, Dhanyakataka and Dravida,
They roughly correspond to the modern-day Indian states of Andhra Pradesh and Tamil Nadu in the south of India. While reporting many deserted stupas in the area around modern-day Nepal and the persecution of Buddhists by Sangha in the kingdom of Gowda in modern-day West Bengal. Xuanzang, so it seems, it was sort of flourishing towards the south in that period. Xuanzang complements the patronage of Harshavardhana during the same period. After Harshavardhana's kingdom, the rise of many small kingdoms that led to the rise of the Rajputs across the Gangetic plains and marked the end of Buddha's ruling clans, along with a sharp decline in royal patronage until a revival under the Pala Empire in the Bengal region. So the Rajputs being like the kind of the local lords, really, sort of somewhat equivalent to the lords in if you're familiar with European history, that there was this kind of always a struggle between the lords who wanted to keep their little fiefdoms and the kings who wanted to unify things. So the Rajputs being the local lords of the towns and cities. And so the rise of the Pala dynasty being in the Bengal region. Here Mahayana Buddhism flourished and spread to Bhutan and Sikkim between the 8th and the 12th centuries before the Palas collapsed under the assault of the Hindu Sena dynasty. The Palas like the kind of the latest or the last sort of glorious Buddhist kingdom in India. The Palas created many temples and a distinctive school of Buddhist art. Xuanzang noted in his travels that in various regions Buddhism was giving way to Jainism and Hinduism. By the 10th century, Buddhism had experienced a sharp decline beyond the Pala regions in Bengal under a resurgent Hinduism and the incorporation in Vaishnavite Hinduism of Buddha as the ninth incarnation of Vishnu. A milestone in the decline of Indian Buddhism in the north occurred in 1193 when Turkic Islamic raiders under Muhammad Khilji burnt Nalanda. By the end of the 12th century, following the Islamic conquest of the Buddhist strongholds in Bihar, and of course which is ancient Magadha, and their loss of political support coupled with social and caste pressures, the practice of Buddhism retreated to the Himalayan foothills in the north and Sri Lanka in the south. Additionally, the influence of Buddhism also waned due to Hinduism's revival movements such as Advaita, the rise of the Bhakti movement, and the missionary work of Sufis. Of course, the story of the ending of Buddhism in India being a fascinating and complex topic, and like all the topics in this region, in this area, is only imperfectly understood. So the Pala Empire being the as I said, the last sort of great Buddhist kingdom. And when you go to India today and you see a lot of the monuments in the Buddhist holy sites, most of them actually date from the Pala period. So most of what we're actually seeing, because the monuments were kind of successively built up and repaired and so on, so the last layer of bricks and things which we're actually seeing exposed is often from the Pala period. Pala. Eight ten to 850. So that's it under its height. It's obviously a massive kingdom. Pala. Again, Pala meaning guardian. Yeah, similar meaning to Gupta. So. So here's a Pala. 11th century Pala thing. And again, you see a lot of this. The sculptures and so on, you see it places like Bodh Gaya and so on are from the Pala period. See, there's a description here. Not quite sure exactly of all the details here, but that looks to me these are probably bodhisattvas on the sides. So this being a later development of the Buddha image. So it's interesting to see the continuities, like the lotus seat and so on, which has been there for a long time. And the devas, here the devas very similar to in the Gupta period one that we saw before, but then the bodhisattvas being added to it. But still quite marginal, sort of on the side, the Buddha is still the main thing there. Central Asia had been influenced by Buddhism probably almost since the time of the Buddha. According to a legend preserved in Pali, two merchant brothers from Bactria, named Tapusa and Balika, visited the Buddha and became his disciples. They then returned to Bactria and built temples to the Buddha. That's a slightly misleading way of putting it. There's no mention in the early texts of where they come from. It just says that they were merchants. the Burmese say that they were from Burma. Curious enough. Central Asia long played the role of a meeting place between China, India, and Persia.
during the 9th century BCE, the expansion of the former Han to the west brought them into contact with the Hellenistic civilizations of India, especially the Greco-Bactrian kingdoms. Thereafter, the expansion of Buddhism to the north led to the formation of Buddhist communities and even Buddhist kingdoms in the oases of Central Asia. Some Silk Road cities consisted almost entirely of Buddhist stupas and monasteries, and it seems that one of their main objectives was to welcome and service travelers between East and West. The Theravada traditions, of course not meaning Sri Lankan Theravada, but meaning schools of early Buddhism, should say Shravakayana, first spread among the Turkic tribes before combining with Mahayana forms during the 2nd and 3rd centuries BCE to cover modern-day Pakistan, Kashmir, Afghanistan, eastern and coastal Iran, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan. These were the ancient states of Gandhara, Bactria, Parthia, and Sogdia, from where it spread to China. Among the first of these Turkic tribes to adopt Buddhism was the Turki Shahi, who adopt Buddhism as early as the 3rd century BCE. It was not, however, the exclusive faith of this region. There were also Zoroastrians, Hindus, Nestorian Christians, Jews, Manichaeans, and followers of Shamanism, Tengrism, and other indigenous non-organized systems of belief. Okay, so very important to remember that Buddhism has always been flourishing and operating in highly diverse religious environments. That was the case in the Buddha's own life, and obviously even more so in the Central Asian region. Zoroastrians, of course, being the followers of the ancient teacher Zoroaster from Persia. Hindus and Nestorian Christians were like a sort of heretical Christian sect who more or less got kicked out of the West and sort of spread east. I'm not sure if it gives a history here. Nestorianism, it's a Christological doctrine advanced by Nestorius, Patriarch of Constantinople from 428 to 431, which emphasizes the disunion between the human and divine natures of Jesus. So, of course, this has been one of the great discussions in Christianity. And Nestorius's doctrine was a culmination of a philosophical current, blah, 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 blah. So the official Roman Church's doctrine became that Jesus was both fully divine and fully human, so that these two would be laid on top of one another. So the Nestorians said that the human and divine aspects were separate, hence they were heretical, got kicked out of the West, and then spread through to the East as far as China. And there are ancient Chinese churches from around that time, Christian churches, as well as various suttas and things like that. We have a book downstairs called the Jesus Sutras, which tells about that story.
Are they still around?
I'm not sure, actually. Where are we now? Might say here, might say the East Nestorianism, Nestorian Schism. So there's no late mentions of it. So it's flourishing around the 10th century in China, India, and Persia. Certainly didn't survive in China, not so far as I know in India. Probably with the origin of Islam, it would have died on. Okay, so, and Manichaeans being another one of these kind of monotheistic religions from the time. Shamanism, Tengrism. What's Tengrism? You know what Tengrism is? Major belief of Xiongnu, Turkic peoples, Mongols, Hungarian, and Bulgar peoples in ancient times. The sky deity Tengri incorporates aspects of shamanism, animism, totemism, and ancestor worship. So that's more like the local indigenous religion of the area. Okay, various Nikaya schools, and so by Nikaya schools it means the schools of early Buddhism, the Shravakayana schools, persisted in Central Asia and China till around the 7th century CE. Mahayana started to become dominant during the period, but since the faith had not developed a Nikaya approach, Sarvastivadin and Dharmaguptakas remained the vineyas of choice in Central Asian monasteries. Various Buddhist kingdoms rose and prospered in both Central Asian region and downwards into the Indian subcontinent, such as the Kushan Emperor prior to the White Han invasion in the 5th century. Where under the king Mihirkula, they were heavily persecuted. Buddhism in Central Asia started to decline with the expansion of Islam and so on. Muslims accorded, well, that's interesting, Muslims accorded the Buddhists the status of dhimmis as people of the book, such as Christianity of Judaism, and Al-Biruni wrote of the Buddha as a prophet. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? I didn't know that. Buddhism saw a surge during the reign of Mongols following the invasion of Genghis Khan and the establishment of the Ilkhanate and the Chagatai Khanate, who brought their Buddhist influence with them during the 13th century. So Genghis Khan, of course, being a great propagator of Buddhism, unfortunately, but the within, as well as being the greatest personal mass murderer of all time. The Mongols who remained in that region would convert to Islam and spread Islam across the regions, across several Central Asia. Only the Eastern Mongols and the Mongols of the Yuan dynasty would keep Vajrayana Buddhism. So Genghis Khan he promoted religious tolerance in the Mongol Empire. Anyway, so there's different points of view on him, but I believe he actually killed with his own hands a number of hundreds of thousands of people. They'd line up with swords and he'd chop their heads off. Also, interestingly enough, there are, I think, millions of people living today who are actually genetic descendants of Genghis Khan, which perhaps also gives some indication of his recreational activities. Next, Parthia. Where's Buddhism expanded west into the... I've just gone well beyond being able to say these words. Arsacid Parthia, into the area of Merv, ancient Margiana, today's Turkestan of Turkmenistan. Ancient Soviet archaeological teams have excavated near Merv a Buddhist chapel, a gigantic Buddhist statue, as well as a monastery. Parthians were directly involved in the propagation of Buddhism. Anshar Gao, a Parthian prince, went to China and is the first known translator of Buddhist scriptures into Chinese. And so Anshar Gao translated a number of Agama Sutras into Chinese, not full Agamas, but significant bodies of Agama Sutra translations, which are probably among the earliest datable of the Agama literature, as well as the Gandhari manuscripts. The eastern part of Central Asia has revealed extremely rich Buddhist works of art, wall paintings and reliefs, numerous caves, portable paintings on canvas, sculpture, ritual objects displaying multiple influences from Indian and Hellenistic styles. Serendipian art is highly reminiscent of the Gandharan style, and scriptures in the Gandhari script Kharoshthi have been found. Central Asians seem to have played a key role in the transmission of Buddhism to the east. So a number of them listed here, Anshar Gao, Answan, Lokshema, and so on. The majority of translators, so here we have a blue-eyed Central Asian and East Asian Buddhist monks. From Central Asia somewhere, yeah. Ninth century fresco. A person left is a European or Western Asian trader or monk, distinguished by his red hair and full beard and face. And the right is an East Asian person.
Indian. I read about this place. They're
both men, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There were
these frescoes and paintings, and they're all
ripped out from paintings. As you do? Yeah. So isn't that
Indian? He's got blue eyes.
No, but the
detail.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether that's just a sign, a thing taken from Buddha images, iconography, or whether they actually have.
No, they just copied.
I don't know. It could have been just a convention that they used. I really don't know.
Yeah. They even attributed to the Western person.
Yeah, yeah.
The one on the right hand side is the Buddha or just the
monk? Chinese monk. Two Chinese monks.
And neither of them is Chinese. They read the Sutta.
That's what it is.
Yeah, that's Bhante
Chan. Oh, no, but the hair.
It's good.
a young man with Parthian.
Syria.
So, just go back, Central Asia. Khotan. Ancient Buddhist kingdom on the Silk Road. Okay, then Buddhism in China first arrived in China from the 1st century CE from Central Asia. So it's interesting to remember that Buddhism was actually in China before. I mean, we have records of Buddhism in China before it was in, say, Thailand and Burma. A little bit after it arrived in Sri Lanka, only a couple of hundred years after it was in Sri Lanka, long before it was ever in Tibet. The year 67 CE saw Buddhism's official introduction to China with the coming of the two monks, Moto and Chufar Lan. 68 BC, under imperial patronage, they established the White Horse Temple, which still exists today. First known Mahayana scriptural texts are translations made into Chinese by the Kushan Man Lokakshema in Lower Yang between 178 and 189 CE. So very often, the Chinese have recorded the dates of their translations, and that gives us the best information that we've got for the actual dates of these things. We don't have any firm dates for Mahayana texts that are actually in Indic languages, so we rely on the Chinese translation dates to somehow date the text, which of course is very uncertain. They could have been, the texts themselves could have existed for hundreds of years before they were translated. But this gives us, at least, we know that the text must have existed by this time. So this is why we mentioned before that there's the discussion of the origins of the Mahayana in terms of, like, when did it first come to be. I mean, we know that it was existing in China in 178 CE, so that's a fairly firm date. So it must have been in India for at least a while before that. So that puts us back into the first century of the Common Era as sort of, you know, at the very latest, and quite possibly a bit earlier. So that's really how we infer that Mahayana originated around the first century, either before or after the Common Era.
So, but didn't go to China
to Buddhism? No. The early Buddhism went there as well. So there were early Buddhist texts there already by the time that the Mahayana texts were translated, but the Mahayana texts became very popular very quickly. Yeah. Okay.
So where did Buddhism spread in Ashoka?
Well, you remember the map of the Ashokan Empire, so that's pretty much the extent of it as far as we know. It's said that it went to Suvarnabhumi, which would be Lower Burma probably, in the Mon region, but actually there's no archaeological evidence for Buddhism there until quite a few hundred years later. So it's not sure, it could be just an absence of evidence, but most Western scholars think that actually Buddhism didn't go to that region until quite a few hundred years later.
Why is it
in where?
In this area,
Well, at that time, and from the earliest times, there would have been a variety of the early schools there, and some of those are described, especially by some of the Chinese pilgrims. What was his name? I'm not sure if none of it was one of the others. Yijin, writing, I think, about 8th or 9th century. And travel quite extensively in that region, and actually makes a description and says, you know, in Vietnam it's the such and such school, in Indonesia it's the such and such school, so it describes all the different areas in which school flourished there. So it was only later that after that period, then the sort of tantric Buddhism became very popular, say in Borobudur and other places, and also there's the Khmer Kingdom, Angkor Wat is like a Buddhist Hindu tantric syncretic thing. And so really the fact of Theravada as we know it today predominating in that region came with the collapse of Buddhism in India. And what I think happened was that when Buddhism collapsed in India around 11th and 12th centuries, because the centre's like being withdrawn, so the periphery is sort of becomes much less secure, and so that there was a tendency to then integrate. And then the King Parakramabahu in Sri Lanka at the time was a very strong king. and he actually attempted to invade some of the Southeast Asian countries. From Sri Lanka, there were attempts at that around that period. So I think it was under that influence that they gradually formed the sort of almost exclusive Theravadan Sri Lankan influence in those areas. Yeah. But this is one of the things that's fascinating about Strong's book, because they're talking about Upagupta, because one of the significances of Upagupta is this kind of the remnants of Sarvastivadin and other Buddhist schools in modern-day Theravadan regions. So even though Theravada was adopted as the official doctrine, actually people keep on practicing and a lot of beliefs and things are passed down.
So part of the withdrawal to the original, what they assume to be original, rather than it was there from the beginning and stay there.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, what we call, I think, I prefer to think of what we call today as Theravada from about the 12th and 13th centuries. Before that, what we call Theravada was really the doctrine of the Mahavihara. It was like one of the three main Sri Lankan schools,
yeah,
and didn't have any influence outside that, really. Yeah. Okay, so some of the earliest known Buddhist artifacts found in China are small statues on money trees, dated circa 200 CE in typical Gandharan style. Well, the tree with money growing, yeah, it doesn't grow on. Yes, yes. Yeah.
And you don't have any garland stuff, it's sticking on the tree.
Yeah, a bit like a Christmas tree.
Oh, that would be a Christmas tree.
Yeah. Not in China, they don't have?
I didn't see the China.
I'm not familiar with that particular. If we say money tree Buddha, we'll probably just get a lot of. So maybe something like that.
Money
tree. Is what it was. This one?
This.
No, it's just a pot plant.
That's a pot plant. It looks like.
Anyway. Alright. Money trees. Blah, blah, blah. Buddhism flourished during the beginning of the Tang Dynasty, 618 to 907. The dynasty was an issue. So I don't know if we want to go any further. We've been through a lot already. So Japan, Southeast Asia, and so on. It's probably taking us a bit far afield. So what we just might mention is the later movement in Indian Buddhism is the emergence of the Vajrayana. So Vajrayana Buddhism, also called Tantric Buddhism, first emerged in eastern India between the 5th and 7th centuries CE. So this is now moving into what I call the late period. So the early period, like 500 years from the Buddha to the beginning of the Common Era, and then from beginning of the Common Era to about 500 CE is the middle period, where we see the formation of the mature Abhidhamma systems and the emergence of the Mahayana. And then the late period is the period of the emergence of Vajrayana or Tantric Buddhism. And that's the late period also witnesses the decline and eventual disappearance of Buddhism from India. And Tibetan Buddhism, of course, being representative of so generally speaking, Theravada represents early Buddhism. The Chinese Buddhism represents middle period Buddhism, and Tibetan Buddhism represents late period Buddhism from India. Vajrayana Buddhism, also called Tantric Buddhism, first emerged in ancient India between 5th and 7th centuries CE. It's sometimes considered a sub-school of Mahayana and sometimes a third major vehicle, Yana, of Buddhism in its own right. I mean, in fact, the Tibetan tradition, they'll study the early Buddhist teachings and the Mahayana teachings, and then finally they'll study the Vajrayana teachings. Vajrayana is an extension of Mahayana Buddhism in that it does not offer new philosophical perspectives, but rather introduces additional techniques, upaya, or skillful means, including the use of visualizations and other yogic practices. Many of the practices of Tantric Buddhism are common with Hindu Tantricism, the use of mantras, yoga, and the burning of sacrificial offerings. So the Vajrayana, sometimes also called Tantrayana, as I mentioned there, Tantric Buddhism. Or early Vajrayana practitioners were forest-dwelling Mahasiddhas. who lived on the margins of society, those kind of crazy wisdom masters. But by the 9th century, Vajrayana had won acceptance at major Mahayana monastic universities such as Nalanda and Vikramashila. Along with much of the rest of Indian Buddhism, Vajrayana was eclipsed in the wake of the late 12th century Muslim invasions. It has persisted in Tibet, where it was wholly transplanted from the 7th to 12th centuries and became the dominant form of Buddhism to the present day, and on a limited basis in Japan as well, where it evolved into Shingon Buddhism. So the tantric teachings and so on are actually found in China in the Taisho canon. Most of them, although some of the very latest ones are only found in Tibetan. But there were sporadically tantric schools and influences in Chinese Buddhism and Japanese Buddhism, but far less influential in general than it was in Tibet. And so the Theravadan Renaissance, and this is what we were just talking about earlier, from the 11th century, the destruction of Buddhism in the Indian mainland by Islamic invasions led to the decline of the Mahayana faith in Southeast Asia. Continental routes through the Indian subcontinent being compromised, direct sea routes between the Middle East through Sri Lanka and China developed, leading to the adoption of the Theravada Buddhism of the Pali canon introduced to the region around the 11th century CE from Sri Lanka. King Anarata, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, the historical founder of the Burmese Empire, so this is 1044 to 1077, unified the country and adopted the Theravada Buddhist faith. This initiated the creation of thousands of Buddhist temples at Pagan, the capital, between the 11th and 13th century. Around 2,000 of them are still standing. So, so here's some of the pictures of the Pagan stupas. Like this whole kind of landscape of stupas then. So quite an extraordinary landscape, isn't it?
I don't remember it being so good.
The power of the Burmese waned with the rise of the Thai, with the seizure of the capital Pagan by the Mongols in 1287, but Theravada Buddhism remained the main Burmese faith to this day. Theravada faith was also adopted by the newly founded ethnic Thai kingdom of Sukhothai around 1260. Theravada Buddhism was further reinforced during the Uthaya period, 14th through 18th century, becoming an integral part of Thai society. Theravada Buddhism continued to expand into Laos and Cambodia in the 13th century. However, from the 14th century, along the coastal fringes and the islands of Southeast Asia, the influence of Islam proved stronger, expanding into Malaysia, Indonesia, and most of the islands as far as the southern Philippines. Okay, so those areas formerly having a strong Buddhist influence. However, since 1966, with Suharto's rise of power and the aftermath of the bloody events after the so-called Sabta blah blah, there's been a remarkable renaissance of Buddhism in Indonesia. Okay, so estimated 10 million Buddhists in Indonesia, mostly of Chinese ancestry. And then going on to talk a little bit about the spread to the West, and of course the most famous event being the story of Balaam and Yosafat, and Yosafat being a sort of Western pronunciation of Bodhisat, and the story of Balaam and Yosafat being the story of the Bodhisattva going out and meeting the four signs and so on. And then he was made into a Catholic saint. So the Buddha has actually been made a Catholic saint. It was interesting, we saw earlier that the Muslim writers said that the Buddha was a prophet, and according to the Catholics, they made him a saint. So, thank you for that. They de-saintified him some time ago. Yeah. In the 19th century, when the kind of modern ethnic studies and so on came up, and then people began to be conscious of the fact that a large number of so-called saints were actually adopted pagan deities and things. So the Catholic Church did a sort of massive research into all of that, and de-sanctified a lot of, I don't know what word you use, these saints. We have the book downstairs in the library that gives one of the stories. So, and then of course down to the modern era,
and the story of how Buddhism became adopted in the West in the modern era, also being a fascinating and complex story. We might even might be interesting to invite Judith Snodgrass to come and talk about that. That's her, one of her main areas of interest and study. How Buddhism became adopted in the West and the different processes and so on, what happened in the modern era and colonial era and so on. Yeah. So it's very interesting, you know, they had this story of the Bodhisattva there in the West, and then you had Franciscan friar William of Rubruck sent on an embassy to the Mongol court by the French king, St. Louis, in 1253, in the period after Hulagu, the Mongols, crazy after Buddhism, numerous Buddhist temples, blah, 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 in Persia and Iraq, none of which survived. And, you know, from that period, you know, the missionaries started going into Japan, I think, in about 1600s, and into China and Tibet. So there was translations of Buddhist works from there, that period. But there was actually some very interesting and accurate information about Buddhism in Europe from about the 1600s. But most of it got ignored until it was really the mid-19th century that Buddhism started to become very influential in the West.
Not a great account. So anyway, so there you go, that's enough for one day.